Well, thank you for inviting me, and it's a pleasure to be here with you this morning as we explore your series on divine doubts. And specifically, we're going to look at the question about whether or not God exists. And this question on the existence of God raises a number of problems. The first problem is we have about 30 minutes or so on a Sunday morning to talk about a question that has perplexed very, very bright people for, I don't know, like 4,000 years. So the material on the existence of God is vast, and we can't even begin to scratch the surface. But we're going to do the best we can. But we do need to remember that little problem. Another problem is the material on the existence of God is fairly complicated. It is fairly specialized. Once you start to get into the material, going back before even Greek philosophy, some Eastern philosophy, it is complicated material. Now, while I do work in philosophy, I work in a philosophy department, my area of specialization is in something a little bit different. I'm not a philosopher of religion, but I've done quite a bit of work in philosophy of religion, and while it's not my area of specialization, I have a bit of competency, and I'm going to try the best I can to take some of that material and almost like regurgitate it, right? Reinterpret it for us this morning. But this issue of the complicated nature of this material and why it does, we have to be careful with appealing to certain authorities. That's going to come back in a few minutes when we start looking at one of the reasons for thinking God exists. A final problem with looking at the question of God's existence is really the question of whether or not there's a God is a question of truth, right? I mean, I want to know, is there a fact that suggests that there is a God or not? That's a truth question. It's a question about reality and whether or not such and such a thing actually obtains in reality. Is there a God or not? But truth is a complicated problem. And seeking truth is a complicated problem. Let me give a principle that can help us be truth seekers. It's called the principle of charity. You may have heard of this already. Keith may explore it again in the future. But the principle goes roughly like this. I need to understand and appreciate and respect my opponent's view better than my opponent before I raise my objection to my opponent. Let me give an example. Imagine question period. Over here we have Mr. Trudeau and Mr. Scheer, right? And Mr. Trudeau believes something. He says, I believe that such and such for reasons X, Y, and Z. Now, over here we have Mr. Scheer. And Mr. Scheer, let's say, doesn't agree. He thinks that that claim is false. But if we are truth seekers, this whole conversation would look something like this, roughly. Before Mr. Scheer raises his objections to Mr. Trudeau, he would do this. Actually, Mr. Prime Minister, you said your position like this, but if you say it differently, it would be better. That is to say, we can make your position even stronger. Mr. Scheer doesn't agree with the position, but he's going to help Mr. Trudeau make his position even better. So it's not even the way that Mr. Trudeau has expressed the position, but Mr. Scheer may say, you know what, you used reasons X, Y, and Z to support your position. Guess what? Reasons A, B, C are even better. That's a better way to support your position. Notice there hasn't been any objection yet. All we're trying to do is be charitable with the people we don't agree with. And we're going to help them make their position as strong as we can make it. Why? Well, we care about what's true. Presumably, we care about what's true. And then once Mr. Scheer, Mr. Trudeau establish, yes, you know what, this is the best way to present the position, then Mr. Scheer raises the objection. Here's why I don't agree with that position. And what does Mr. Trudeau do? He helps Mr. Scheer present the objection. You said the objection like this, and, you know, he doesn't take advantage of how he said it. Sometimes we say things, it's not very clear, right? We could have said it better. We don't take advantage of that. We don't jump on that. We actually say, you know, you could have said it better. You could have made it stronger. And your reasons, we have better reasons. Well, let's modify those reasons. So Mr. Trudeau is helping Mr. Scheer with the objection against his own view. And then once they've established, yes, this is a good objection to the position, then Mr. Trudeau can raise his response. And back and forth. And why do they do this? Because they want to figure out whether or not the position is true. And to figure out whether or not something is true does require that I invite my critics. I invite them because they don't see it the same way as me. And it's very hard for me to get outside of my own view. Or if I'm in a group and we all think the same way, it's very hard sometimes to get out of that. So we invite opponents. What's your objection? And to be charitable with them. Here's the problem with this whole thing of truth-seeking and charity. It's pretty much impossible. That's the problem. I teach a critical thinking class at the University of Ottawa, and we go on and on and on about charity. And at the end, what do? We do a really big experiment, and all the students fail. And the experiment is to show that we can't even do this. I can't even do it. And I'm supposed to teach it. This is a very hard thing to do. It's very hard to seek truth. So ask yourself this question. Are you a truth seeker? Or are you someone that just goes out and finds the material that confirms your own view? And that's a challenge for all of us in all kinds of different domains. So when we're talking about the existence of God, do we care about whether or not it's true? And if we do, then we have to go to some scary places. We have to become vulnerable. I have to hear from people who don't agree with me, who have some pretty good objections. And I have to make their objection stronger than they can make it and see whether or not the truth of Christianity can stand up to that. And if it's true, all right, nothing to worry about. This may come back as we work through one of the positions I'm going to outline this morning. We're going to outline the position, but we're also going to look at an objection to the position. But I would encourage you to push yourself willfully as a truth seeker. Not just with God and faith, but with anything. Any position that you believe. Test yourself whether or not you're a truth seeker. What kind of books do you read? Do you read books that are just confirming your own view? What kind of YouTube stuff do you follow? Right? Test yourself. Am I actually considering best objections? So we're going to look at one position for believing that God exists, and it's called the fine-tuning argument for the existence of God. Now, when I use the word argument, I don't mean that I'm going to yell at you about the existence of God and you're going to yell back at me, right? If my daughter and I are in an argument, she's only six, but it happens now and again, we're actually kind of like raising our voices and we're not reasoning, we're not being charitable with one another. It's an argument in that sense. That's not what the word argument means in the technical sense. An argument, in a more technical, formal way, is really you have a conclusion, I believe that such and such, or therefore such and such. And then I have reasons for believing that such and such. So an argument is a very formal structure, right, to help us decide whether or not something is true. And the fine-tuning argument, there's two parts to it. We're going to look at two parts. The first part of the fine-tuning argument for the existence of God is a science part. We're going to look at a little bit of science, some stuff about the universe. And as I said, I'm not a scientist, but I'm going to bring some scientists into our presentation. But that's the first part. It's more a science-y part. And then the second part of the argument is explaining that science. So we have two parts, science and explanation. And then after we've gone through the argument, we're going to look at an objection, and then we're going to talk about why we should even care about any of this, right? That's how we'll wrap it up. So the first part of the argument, the fine-tuning argument for the existence of God, comes from a number of people who have worked on this argument, but I'm going to give you a name. His name is Luke Barnes. He's an astronomer, and he's become a little bit more popular these days. and he really specializes on the fine-tuning argument for the existence of God. He's well qualified. He's got lots of good YouTube material. He's also come out with a book that he co-authored with his colleague. And so he's the guy. I'm going to try and regurgitate or reinterpret the material, but if you want the details, I'm going to forward you off to Luke Barnes, the astronomer. So what is the science part of the fine-tuning argument? Well, it goes roughly like this. The universe, our universe, is fine-tuned in the sense that it is a universe with precise conditions for realizing creatures like us, humans. And what kind of creatures are we? Well, there's three interesting things about humans. Number one, we have bodies. We're embodied creatures. We're not unembodied creatures. We're not like these immaterial things. We have bodies. That's an important fact about being human. Number two, we're conscious. I have my own mental life up here that's mine. What is it like to be me? My conscious world. You have no access to it. It's mine, and you have yours. That's a very unique thing about creatures in our universe, that they're conscious. So we have bodies, and we're conscious. And the third thing that's interesting about people, humans like us, creatures like us, is that we're moral creatures. I have moral intuitions or moral instincts. We live in moral communities. Right? We live a certain kind of way with regard to right and wrong. So we are embodied, conscious, moral creatures. And the fine-tuning argument will say, look, the universe has to be just right if you want to build those types of creatures. Now, to understand this a little bit better, Barnes gives a nice analogy. So I want you to imagine a cake recipe. Right? So I have a recipe, and if I follow that recipe carefully, I will hopefully be able to produce an edible cake. Now, if it was me following the recipe, it would not be edible. My wife can do it without a recipe, right? But the idea is you have a recipe, these very, very fine-tuned things to produce an edible cake. And the universe is similar. There's a recipe. If you want to build a universe, and not just any universe, you want to build a universe that can inhabit these special types of creatures. What creatures? Embodied, conscious, moral creatures. Then you have to have a very precise recipe. Now, what's interesting about this is that in the cake example, with the cake recipe, I could probably diverge slightly from the recipe, right? I mean, I don't know anything about making cakes, but you could probably add a little bit more sugar or take out a little bit more sugar. You could probably add a little bit more flour. I don't know, maybe not. Nope. No, you can't. You can't add flour. you could, well, now I don't even know. But you could probably, you know, you don't have to bake it at 300. Too high, too low. My wife's like, face palm. But the idea is with the cake recipe, you probably can modify things slightly. Not too much, right? I can't add a brick to the recipe, right? I can't add motor oil to the recipe. You can't diverge too much, but there's probably some wiggle room with the recipe. With the recipe for a universe to inhabit creatures like us, you can't touch it. And Barnes will give you the numbers, and it's mind-blowing. You cannot adjust that recipe. I mean, to use the cake analogy again, if I pull out one grain of sugar, right? The cake would fall apart. If I pull out that one little thing from the universe, from the recipe for the universe, the whole thing falls apart. You don't end up with creatures like us. So you have to have these very precise conditions. And if you change them, you no longer have a universe that is life-permitting. You no longer have a universe that can occupy creatures like us. So this is the science part to the fine-tuning argument. And as I understand it, most scientists actually agree with this. Like they think that this is a pretty well-established way of looking at the universe. Most of these people believe that there's no God, but they look at the evidence. They say, yeah, our universe seems to exhibit that very strange quality. Now, not everyone agrees with that. There's a few people who are cosmologists. They study the cosmos and the universe, and they don't agree. But the consensus, and that's important, the consensus of those who specialize on this generally seem to agree, look, yes, the universe is fine-tuned for creatures like us. So that's part one. That's the science of the fine-tuning argument. The second part is an explanation part. So now we're going into a non-scientific domain. And we want to explain this phenomenon. We want to explain this observation, this universe that we're looking at, this recipe that we're looking at. What explains this? Or what's a good explanation of this? Now, the word explanation raises some problems. We won't talk about them. The only thing I'll say about the term explanation in this case is really what we're asking is what are the causes? So when I want to know what explained that, what I'm asking in this case is, well, what are the things that led up to realizing that thing, the causes? Right? My children have a fight, and I want someone to explain what just happened. When I do that, really, I'm trying to figure out, okay, what are all the things that happened that led up to the fight? Right? That's what we mean. That's what we mean when we say the word explanation. So, in the fine-tuning example, we want to say, well, what explains this fine-tuning for creatures like us? Now, to try to understand this, let's consider a different analogy. Imagine you are walking along the beach, and you come across a very elegant sandcastle. And it has, towers and this really nice door and, a big moat around, and it has maybe some writing on it. It's this incredible structure that's made in the sand. And you can ask the question, what explains the sandcastle? That is to say, what caused the sandcastle, or what series of causes realized the sandcastle? And let's say you've got two choices. Choice number one is, let's say, the intuitive choice. Well, it was a dad, right? A dad with his kids, and they have some buckets and some shovels, and they got together, and the dad has like this design plan, and the dad's like, you know what, we're going to do this and this, and don't do that, you know, son, don't do it that way, do it like this, and stop breaking it, right? Because the dad gets passionate about building the best sandcastle. That's me, if you're wondering. And really, it ends up the kids go and do something else, and it's just dad, building the sandcastle. But the idea is that that's one explanation. One explanation for the existence of the sandcastle is that there was a designer, an agent who has intentions, a plan, and then that designer is part of that causal process. The designer is part of the causes that led up to building that sandcastle. That's one possibility. The other possibility is, well, over a very, very long period of time, the wind and the waves and some erosion and, the crawling critters and falling leaves, over a very long period of time, those things created the sandcastle. And let's call that second explanation the no designer explanation. So we have two explanations for the existence of this sandcastle. We have the designer explanation and the no designer explanation. Both involve causes. It's just that in the first one you have an agent, a designer, and in the second one you don't. All right, that's the first sandcastle. Now I want you to imagine you're walking a little bit farther down the beach and you come across another sandcastle. Now this one isn't quite as elegant as the first one, right? The first one's pretty impressive. This one is still really creative and elegant. It's got some incredible, spirals, and it's got this really cool looking door and this amazing ramp, and you're looking at this structure and you ask that same question. What explains this incredibly elegant structure? And you have those two possibilities again. You can say the designer explanation, it was a dad with his kids and some shovels and buckets, or you could say it was the wind and the waves and some erosion and the crawling critters, and over time you end up with this elegant structure. Now, let's say, for the sake of argument, let's say that in the first case, that first sandcastle, that's the designer one. Let's say that the best explanation for explaining that first sandcastle is the designer explanation. And let's say, for the sake of argument, that in the second case, this second sandcastle, it's the no designer explanation. This second sandcastle that I'm looking at, there is no agent behind it. There is no designer. It's just the wind and the waves, the erosion. And you know what? Nature created some really interesting stuff. So we have the first sandcastle, designer. The second sandcastle, no designer. You with me? All right. Here's the complicated question. When we are looking at the fine-tuning of the universe, so I look at the universe, and it's been fine-tuned to make embodied, conscious, moral creatures. What explains that observation? Is it more like the first sandcastle, where you have the designer explanation? Or is that fine-tuning more like the second sandcastle? It looks designed. It looks really, really elegant. But really, there's no designer. Which one is it? And how do we answer that question? That's a pretty tough question to answer. Now, if I believe that there's a God, then I'm probably like pulled towards the designer explanation, right? The fine-tuning of the universe for embodied, conscious, moral creatures. That's more similar to that first sandcastle, right? That one you need a designer. But there are some people, they don't see it that way. And they're perfectly sincere, some of my colleagues. They try really hard to think about this, and they're sincere, and they don't see it. Now, what do I have to do? I have to apply the principle of charity. I want to try and figure out why they're thinking that way. So this raises our objection. We want to try and understand the person who's over here and says, look, I look at the fine-tuning of the universe for life and embodied, conscious, moral creatures, and I don't see it like the first sandcastle. I don't think that a good explanation of that is a designer. I actually see it more like the second sandcastle, where it just looks really elegant, it appears designed, and there's no designer. Okay, why do they think that way? People who think this way don't agree with the fine-tuning argument. They have an objection. So here's the objection. Here's one of the objections. You can find this objection in more detail in Barnes, or there's some other people who have talked about it. It goes something like this. Our universe is fine-tuned for life, for creatures like us. But guess what? That's just one universe. There's more than one. There's millions of universes. And they all have slightly different recipes. And you know what? If you have a billion different choices, a billion different slightly tweaked recipes, you're going to end up with one that's going to have creatures like us. And you know what? In the trillionth one over there, it probably has slightly different creatures. So they look at that and like, eh, I don't see the designer, I just see coincidence. And that's a sincere way that people think. And to appreciate this, remember, we're trying to be charitable. I probably won't be able to present their objection or their position as well as they can, but let's try our best. So let's try and get into their mind. People who believe that there's no God, and they've read the fine-tuning argument, and they're not convinced by it. They don't think it's a good argument. What's going on? Here's one possibility. On YouTube, you can watch these really, really creative videos about, like, Earth, and it's like the size of Earth relative to the sun, and then they keep going. They're incredible, really. And I watched one of these not too long ago, and you know, it starts on Earth, and they show you the size of Earth, and then they show you, well, look at Earth relative to Saturn, you know, and Saturn's a lot bigger, and then look at this relative to Jupiter, and it keeps backing up, and you're like, look at all of this relative to the sun. And of course, the sun is huge. And then they back up the video more. And you look at the size of our solar system. That's a big, giant thing. The sun is huge, and yet it's tiny when you're looking at it within the scope of a solar system. And then I find out, well, guess what? That's just one solar system in our whole galaxy. And you back up and you see the entire galaxy. And I don't know, there's what, like a billions and billions of solar systems in our galaxy? That's already blowing my mind. I don't know if I have the data right, but as I understand it, that could be the case. And that's mind-blowing. But then the video will pull back. That's just one galaxy. And it could be that there are trillions of galaxies in the universe. Like, I don't even know, I can't even comprehend a trillion, let alone a billion. I can't do it. That's overwhelming for me. And you back up and you see the vast scope of the universe. Like a trillion galaxies that have billions and billions of solar systems with billions and billions of stars and planets. It's overwhelming for me. But then you back up right to the end of the video. That's one universe. Now you've got a million or a billion universes that have trillions of solar systems and billions of galaxies. So the person who's not convinced by the argument, sometimes, if we're being charitable, they will look at that and they will say, look, you have like an infinite possibility. Look at all those recipes for building universes. Yes, maybe most of them aren't going to give you a life-permitting universe, but one or two may do it, and we just happen to be that fortunate universe. Now, there are responses to that, and if you like to read Barnes or you read some of these other folks who specialize on this, they will offer responses, and you go back and forth, and you have a good conversation or a good debate about which explanation of fine-tuning seems more reasonable. But at the end of the day, the jury's kind of out on this. When you look at the literature, you're going to have people who believe that there's a God, and they find the argument quite convincing. Yes, I think that the best explanation of fine-tuning is a God. It's like the first sandcastle. Believe it or not, though, there are some Christian philosophers and Christian scientists who are not actually convinced by this. So there are some Christians even who don't think it's a good argument. But as far as I know, most think it's pretty good. And then on the other side, you have some people who believe that there's no God, and some of them, most of them are not convinced, but actually there are some who think it's a good argument. Like these people do not believe there's a God, but they go, yeah, that's a good argument. I could see how that would be persuasive. It doesn't convince me, but I can see how it can be sensible and perfectly rational to believe that there's a God using fine-tuning. So ultimately you have like support for it, but not like unanimous support. So the jury's out. So then, you know, what do we do in this particular case when there's this kind of disagreement? Let me offer some suggestions. The first suggestion is arguments like this are not proofs for the existence of God. So if you are chatting with someone who believes that there's no God and you present the fine-tuning argument for the existence of God, which again is what? Our universe has been built with precise conditions for permitting creatures like us. And that's a very strange thing. It requires an explanation. And that explanation is God. There it is. And you present this, but that's not a proof, at least in the typical way that we use the word proof. A proof, like in, say, logic, is like a proof. You can prove the conclusion. You have this and this, and you have to have the conclusion, or like in math. But that's not what this argument is. And most arguments, as I understand them, for the existence of God are not proofs. They're support for the existence of God. We're trying to support the claim. So we should be careful with the word proof. Now, there are some classical arguments for the existence of God where they are actually proofs. And some would say those are some of the best arguments for the existence of God. But that's a different issue. But in this case, it's not a proof. It's just support. A second implication, a second thing that we should care about, is that these arguments may not even convince people. They may. God can do lots of things, right? The Holy Spirit can use anything, really, or most things, to draw people unto God, including arguments like this. But they may not do that, and they may not be, maybe they're not supposed to do that. Maybe they're not supposed to be convincing. I've talked with lots of folks who believe that there's no God, and they're not convinced by some of these arguments. Now, some of these people are not, they're not truth seekers. They're not real truth seekers. Some of them are. And even the ones who are still don't find it convincing. But maybe that's not what the arguments are for. They're not meant to convince people that God exists. Here's the third claim. Here's a third way of thinking about what these arguments do, given that, you know, the jury's kind of out on what they say. These arguments are meant to support believers. That's what they do. They support your faith as you're exploring divine doubts. You and I have reasons, good reasons, for thinking that there's a God. They're not like proofs. This one's not a proof, but they're good reasons. It's perfectly sensible and rational and reasonable for me to believe that there's a God. And I can use some of the scientific data to show that. I can't prove it, but since when are we trying to do that? We're just trying to give a strong position. And that's what these arguments could be doing. So when we explore those divine doubts, when we ask those tough questions, and we should ask those tough questions, we be confident there are good arguments for the existence of God. That's important. And I meet students all the time who are brought up in a Christian context. They go to university, they take a class, and we push them very, very hard, and they reject some of the stuff that they've believed before, in this case, their faith. But they're not taking time to become familiar with good arguments. These are good arguments for the existence of God. Now, there may come a time when the fine-tuning argument is no longer a good argument. Maybe we'll learn some new stuff. Okay, fine. Who cares? Get rid of it. There's like 1,000 arguments for the existence of God. There's lots. Some are good, some are bad. Find the good ones. They will help us as we explore our doubts. And a final note that I think we should consider, why care about any of this? Why care about the argument? Why care about supporting my faith as I explore divine doubts? Why should I do this? Here's one suggestion. Because it is an excellent example of truth seeking for people who are not seeking Christ. For example, if I'm trying to show my colleagues, many of whom do not believe that Christianity is true, some think it's crazy, some think I'm crazy, if I can show them I'm a truth seeker, in fact, I know your position better than you. That objection that you raised, I know that objection better than you do. You didn't even present it the right way. Right? I know it better. I can challenge my view better than you can. And what does that do? It gives them the insight and the example to say, you know what, I need to consider the person of Jesus seriously. The truth about that. I need to consider that with charity. They'll see us doing that. They'll see us challenging our own view. And they, not in all cases, but conjoined with the Holy Spirit, they will see, okay, look, these people aren't just about confirming their own biases. They're being vulnerable. They're going out there. And they're looking at the best objections. They understand my view better than I do. I can tell you from experience, that encourages the skeptic to do the same thing. And that's what we want them to do, right? We want them to find the truth about Jesus. But we have to be willing to do the same thing. We have to be willing to be truth seekers too, and that's a scary business. So why should we care about these arguments? Because they're good support for the existence of God, and that can help us navigate our divine doubts and set a good example for those who are seeking Christ. Thank you.